Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Current and Future Role of Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors and Other Novel Therapies in the Management of Urothelial Bladder Cancer. We're really excited. We have an outstanding faculty of two urologic oncologists, two medical oncologists going to be chatting about this today. Here's where we're heading tonight, talking about four of the most interesting aspects, I think, of this disease and where we're heading with it. We'll start out talking about the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors for non-muscle invasive disease. Then we'll talk about neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy for muscle invasive disease. We'll talk about how checkpoint inhibitors are being used now in advanced urothelial bladder cancer, and then new directions in terms of where we're heading. And Ashish, you know, it's really amazing when you take a step back and look at all the things that have happened in this field in the last couple of years. Any comment, any perspective about how things are different now, both in terms of research and practice, in terms of urothelial bladder cancer, Ashish?
So, Neil, thanks again for inviting me to be part of this panel. It's always a pleasure to join you and the rest of my colleagues, C.A. Arjun and Jonathan. As you recognized, you know, there's been an explosion when it comes to therapies for bladder cancer, and we really didn't have much going on other than minute variations in which drug to use and which chemo cocktail and combinations. But obviously, then there was this explosion of therapies when it comes to immuno-oncology. And that started out first in the metastatic setting, and of course there's where the approvals were in the cisplatinum ineligible, and then different variations coming down. And then lo and behold, in the early part of 2020, before we all kind of got relegated to our living rooms from COVID-19, it was approved for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, which is a huge win for our patients and the community. So lots of excitement, lots of things going on in this arena.
So, Jonathan, any comment about sort of the biology of urothelial bladder cancer and maybe the connection to checkpoint inhibitors? We know that, you know, smoking is a factor with bladder cancer, with lung cancer as well, where checkpoint inhibitors are approved. Can you comment a little bit, Jonathan, about sort of the responsiveness that we see in general to checkpoint inhibitors with this disease?
So we have evidence, as we do in other diseases, that tumors with higher tumor mutation burden are more responsive to immunotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor. And bladder cancer has probably the third highest tumor mutation rate behind lung cancer and melanoma. And so at the outset, one would have predicted that bladder cancer would be responsive to immunotherapy. But that isn't the whole story. There's a lot more complexity around where the immune cells are in the tumor that we're still learning about. And we've learned a lot from ongoing and reported clinical trials helping us understand what's happening in the tumor microenvironment that I think in the future we'll be able to use to better select patients for immunotherapy and enrich for the likelihood of people responding to treatment.
And Arjun, we're going to mainly focus on the use of checkpoint inhibitors, and then we're going to get into novel agents as well in this disease. And one of the underlying themes is toxicity and the awareness of that. Medical oncologists now are using checkpoint inhibitors in so many different diseases. They have a lot of exposure to the subtleties of how autoimmune toxicity presents. Just kind of curious, Arjun, any comments about that and about the need to follow patients carefully and keep that in mind?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges as we roll out immunotherapy more broadly across our disciplines. And if we try to make the comparison to chemotherapy, I don't think as a medical oncologist you need to treat that many patients before you understand how platinum chemotherapy behaves and the toxicity profile. But you need to treat a lot of people with immunotherapy before you feel comfortable knowing and how to identify and treat, you know, symptomatic pneumonitis or colitis or what have you, because these events don't occur often. But when they do, they can be quite frightening. So it takes a while because they just don't happen that often.
So we're going to start out and focus on the recent evolution of the use of checkpoint inhibitors for non-muscle invasive disease. For each one of these topics, I spent about an hour with each one of the faculty recording a presentation that they've done, which goes through the data in detail and interviewing about their perspectives. We're going to put all that together with this roundtable discussion into a on-demand piece for you all to check out. But Sia, you know, one of the issues that comes up in terms of this first topic that we're going to talk about is the issue of the alternatives to checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, we're going to talk in a second, And Ashish is the one who actually gave the talk. I'm going to ask him to sort of go through the data. But any thoughts, Sia, about sort of now we're bringing in checkpoint inhibitors much earlier into the disease and some of the challenges clinically you see, Sia, in making that happen?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the challenges is where it's administered in most practices, I think. Medical oncologists are delivering the immunotherapy. So typically, even in the BCG non-responsive setting, urologists have always been sort of the driver of the additional therapies and are most familiar with additional intravesical therapy. So I think, you know, that's shifting a little bit as IO, specifically Pembro, got approved for the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that's not responsive to BCG. So we're seeing a little shift there, but on the same token, we also have newer agents and or combination therapy that's available to us. So now we have to make a decision. Do we send this patient off for immunotherapy versus try additional salvage intravesical therapy? So I think we'll talk a little bit about that today.
So here's where we're going to head, and I'm actually going to ask Ashish if he can maybe summarize some of the points that he brought out in his talk. Of course, we're going to focus on the FDA approval and the data behind pembrolizumab, but also data from a SWOG study and looking at atezolizumab in the same situation, and then a couple of cases that Ashish is going to talk about. Maybe we can start out and just briefly comment on sort of how BCG works, Ashish, and the mechanism of action.
So, you know, bottom line, BCG works really well, right? And it works so well because it's such a, for lack of a better term, dirty immunotherapy. It activates pretty much every pathway. As you can see here, it activates natural killer cells, activates Th1, Th2 misshift or balance. I mean, it's even got activity against viral cytokine storm and suppressing that, but upregulating the resistance to viruses. So really, the mechanism of BCG per se is really complicated, and I don't want to go too much into it, but as relevant to this particular talk today, the checkpoint inhibition or the PD-1, PD-L1 axis is active when it comes to the BCG mechanism of action. And that's where the thought process came about. Well, BCG is the original cancer immunotherapy. Urologists have used it for decades. Can we now salvage patients who have not had a durable response to BCG, as shown in this study, which is relatively recent from 2014, a randomized study comparing BCG against chemotherapy? You can see that BCG is clearly better to chemotherapy. We know that. But even then, even in the modern era with appropriate restaging and resection of tumor, about 30 to 40% of patients will have recurrence of high-risk disease at 1 to 2 years. And clearly for these patients, we need an alternative. And till date, really, you know, the classification of BCG failure has been all over the place. This is just a table from my talk and our publication that shows, you know, the confusion that exists. But the FDA, in conjunction with experts from the U.S. and overseas, came up with this response definition called BCG unresponsive disease that clearly changed the playing field when it comes to the development of drugs and trials for registration. And mechanistically, the IOs made perfect sense, right? Because if you can activate pathways that are essentially contributing to the resistance to BCG, can we then test that in this population and come up with a paradigm for our patients? And that's really where the whole treatment paradigm has moved now. So in the BCG unresponsive population, the FDA and other regulatory bodies allow single arm studies, and that's Keynote 57 is one of those. Arjun, was the lead on this and presented this at multiple meetings. This is an extract partly from one of his presentations, but partly also from what we presented at the FDA ODAC meeting, which is, again, public domain. And here we presented cohort A, essentially, which was patients with CIS, with about a papillary disease, who were then reported on to the FDA, because the FDA looks at this particular cohort of patients when it comes to approval of drugs, because CIS is a disease state where we're actually treating disease without completely resecting it, and that's cohort A there. So the patients essentially, you know, were presented to the FDA, the data was presented, and it was approved on January 8, 2020, as depicted here, for patients with CIS with or without papillary tumors who are ineligible for or who refuse radical cystectomy. And that's a key determining statement there, because in today's day and age, even though traditionally we've looked at these agents for patients who are not candidates for radical cystectomy, most patients choose not to have a radical cystectomy. And for them, we need options that are not only effective, but also have durable efficacy, and have durable efficacy with appropriate and acceptable side effect toxicity profiles, which I know Dr. Ballara is going to talk about in more detail.
So yeah, I really want to tease out with the four of you sort of how this is really playing out in clinical practice. But I guess one other thing just to sort of get out on the table before we start talking about how this translates to practice is the SWOG study. Ashish, any comments on that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, obviously pembrolizumab is approved, but it's not the only IO agent. Atezolizumab was studied by the SWOG group, which was the study was led by Peter Black and Singh, SWOG 1605. Very, very similar study design to the pembrolizumab study, Keynote 57, with a few salient differences. In Keynote 57, there was no mandatory biopsy required by the FDA. And I want to specify that required by the FDA is a key statement. It's not as though the company or the PIs did not want to do a biopsy. And discussions with the regulatory bodies, the FDA did not ask for a biopsy, whereas in SWOG 1605, they requested a mandatory biopsy at 6 months. But otherwise, the study design was very, very similar. This study did have to close early because of some stopping rules with toxicity, which unfortunately, you know, there were some adverse events on this study where the trial had to close. But the results are very, very similar to that which we saw in Keynote 57. So if you look at the six-month biopsy mandated response rate in atezo, very similar to extrapolated data from Keynote 57. And if you extrapolate the data from this trial to the three-month response rate, about 40-41%, again, very similar to what we saw in Keynote 57. The durability of response is something that has not yet been reported by the PIs of the study at any public domain meeting. So I can't comment on that per se, because obviously that's still confidential. But that's probably what the FDA is going to look at when they go in front of them for approval purposes.
So I've got to say, to me, this is one of the most interesting developments in all of oncology. You know, so amazing, really, to have to think this thing through the way it is in terms of the clinical situation, Sia. Can you comment a little bit, you know, as a medical oncologist, when she's put up that, you know, list of, you know, different states of BCG, unresponsive or, you know, whatever, can you maybe put that more into a clinical context, Sia, of what the typical clinical situation is where you're thinking about this kind of strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So this will, you know, when we see a patient with high risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, fairly straightforward. Everybody goes to BCG if we can get it. And then we reevaluate the patient at 3 months. They may or may not be okay at that point, but let's say at 6 months you have a suspicious lesion, go to the OR, and now you have recurrent. So at 3 months, you would be getting a maintenance 3 month, 3 week treatment of BCG. So you've received your 6 week induction plus a 3 week maintenance, and at 6 or 7 months, you have a recurrence. That patient is deemed to not be responding to BCG, and we don't recommend any further BCG, whether it be CISTA or T1. Now, I think that's a very, very important point, what kind of disease we have. If we have focal CIS, a small high-grade TA tumor, and we resect those things and the patient is disease-free, we're going to think about that a little bit different than the patient who actually progresses from TA or CIS now to T1 disease. We're not even thinking intravesical therapy at that point for patients who are progressing to high-grade T1 disease. So for those patients, we recommend a radical cystectomy, which will hopefully be curative in the vast majority of those patients. But for the patients who have these focal TA, CIS, recurrent tumors that are not responding to BCG, that's what we're talking about, the ones who within the year are recurring, and now we have to make that decision between salvage, intravesical therapy, and immunotherapy.
So Arjun, I'm curious about your perception about how this plays out. Again, to me, it almost seems unique in oncology. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if you have a patient who's not going to be eligible, refuses, no way they're going to have a cystectomy, that's one thing. But for the patient who is a candidate, it's just such an interesting decision, I think, at least at this point, in terms of cystectomy versus going this other route versus other further intravesicular therapy. Arjun, any comments about how you see this playing out in practice as it's being discussed with patients?
Yeah, so I mean, a little bit of this is an evolving area because you know, before January, it was to counsel a patient about their options outside of cystectomy. It was in the realm of protocols, right? And so January, all of a sudden, the drug is FDA approved, and basically, you know, and there's a little bit of bias here, right? So by the time the patients are referred to me, they're clearly interested in bladder preservation options, and so the conversation naturally steers toward that. You know, the complexity really relies on making sure the patients understand what they're getting into. You know, patients obviously are looking for options that avoid cystectomy, but in non-muscle invasive disease, it is highly curative. And so patients must know that, is that their most curative option is a radical cystectomy. And then they're counseled about the risks of it, the long-term consequences. And if they're willing to accept the risk of saying, well, listen, let's try something different, then I think immunotherapy is a very good option. The important thing is that even after, you know, treatment, they get four cycles of treatment, and they get a cystoscopy. And in the protocol, if the patients didn't achieve a CR at 3 months, and that's a notable, you know, difference between that study and other ongoing studies in non-muscle invasive disease, is that at 3 months, if you didn't have a CR, you came off study. And so that's how, you know, we probably should use it in the real world, which is you get kind of one shot at it. And if at 3 months it's not working, then a patient should be redirected towards surgery.
So, Jonathan, we did this survey of some docs in practice, community-based practice, urologists, as well as medical oncologists. Now, we said, would you generally offer pembrolizumab to, we said in this case, a 50-year-old otherwise healthy patient with BCG unresponsive disease? And the majority of both oncologists and urologists say yes, but, you know, a fairly significant minority would say no. And that minority starts decreasing with age. So 70, you see much more, and then 80 even more. Jonathan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, I don't know how often you see the patient as opposed to your urologist, but how you think through the trade-off here, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like patients often, depends on how you frame the question to them, and depends on the risk of their disease. And so as an oncologist, I tend to unfortunately only see the highest risk non-muscle invasive patients, ones who probably are going to do better with cystectomy in my mind than pembrolizumab. And so, you know, I think it's a tough job counseling them. And then, you know, I feel like I have to talk them out of pembrolizumab in order to let them get pembrolizumab. And maybe a surgeon might feel differently about that. Because I feel like I may be missing a curative window. But there are also patients who have a prolonged natural history, who've had CIS forever, and it's not extensive, and they've never had we know that a long natural history of their disease suggests that it's probably not going to metastasize in the next several months, so therefore those patients are pretty reasonable to pursue a novel approach like pembrolizumab.
So, I'd like you to listen to Ashish's case. He has a case here that I'd like to get your feedback on. We actually have a poll question we're going to ask to the audience based on this case. So we say here's a 68-year-old man with has a TURBT, PT1 high-grade urothelial bladder cancer plus CIS, second resection, PTICS. BCG is started, cystoscopy after 3 months, has a 0.3 centimeter papillary tumor, blue-aided TURBT, PTA low-grade UBC. So, Sia, what would you be thinking about? Is this BCG unresponsive?
No, it's not. You have essentially a very small low-grade cancer. What we really care about is a high-grade cancer. So BCG, I think, has done its job. We don't expect it to work very well with low-grade tumors, but it's really irrelevant. We would make sure that the pathologist is confident with that diagnosis. This scenario doesn't happen often, but it does, where you have the coexistence of low-grade and high-grade disease. So absolutely, we can continue BCG maintenance, and none of the trials that I'm aware of, or very few of them, would this be considered a stopping factor. So we'd continue as long as we don't have any high risk. So the CIS has gone away, the high-grade lesion has gone away, and we're left with a very small low-grade lesion that probably was picked up with the blue light alone, which hopefully will be completely resected and done away with.
So it looks like the majority of the audience agrees with you. Some say, I don't know. Probably they're medical oncologists like me who don't know about it at all. But I just found it really interesting and exciting, though, to hear about these, all these interdisciplinary factors. So Ashish, maybe just briefly tell us what happened with this 68-year-old man.
So really, the point I wanted to make by highlighting that particular case was exactly what Sia mentioned, which is when you have an immunotherapy such as BCG, it's usually going to work against the tumors that have a high mutational burden, which is the higher grade, more aggressive cancers. And if BCG has essentially allowed this patient to be free of high-risk disease, the low-grade recurrences, while a nuisance factor, are not a reason to consider that this patient is falling into any sort of BCG failure or BCG unresponsive category. And in fact, even on clinical trials, the FDA allows patients with low-grade disease to be considered to have a non-event per se. So really, in this case, low-grade recurrence was not a failure, and the patient continued on and did fine.
Ashish, how about this 62-year-old woman?
This case is one that I brought up to highlight a patient with T1 high-grade disease that had a resection. It was 1 centimeter, fairly classic tumor. What's not classic here is the fact that this is a healthy bladder cancer patient, but I didn't want to put that in there so there's no discussion about, well, patient can't tolerate a certain therapy. This patient elected to undergo BCG, had 6 weeks of BCG. At the three-month evaluation was NED, got maintenance therapy, and at 6 months had a positive cytology, blue light was performed, and the blue light here, again, as Sia mentioned, picks up things that we might not have seen 8-10 years ago, but picked up CIS. Now, this patient really said she cannot undergo any organ removal, just refused radical cystectomy. So in this patient who does fall into that highest risk category, T1 high grade with CIS, the options really, when you counsel this patient, are, well, we can't do a radical cystectomy, which is what I would recommend she consider. What other agents do we have? And we talked about intravesical gemcitabine and docetaxel combination, which really has a remarkably high response rate, even though the caveat there is that's not prospective studies. It's multi-center retrospective evaluations. But the response rates are anywhere from 58 to 70% durable at 1 to 2 years. But clearly, the approved drug is what this lady chose, which was pembrolizumab. And it's early still, obviously, but just to highlight that we do have an option that we can talk to the patient about that's approved and available.
So we're going to move on and talk about our next topic, but I do want to ask Sia, you know, when we chatted, you were bringing up the issue of, you know, intravesicular therapy as an alternative to pembrolizumab, and just kind of curious how you would have thought through this case.
Yeah, a great question. And I think Ashish brought up some of those. Gem-Doci has been around for quite some time, and now we have some retrospective series looking at the 1 and 2 year results of up to 50% durable response rate. So we'll see. You know, hopefully we'll have some prospective data soon on that as well. But you know, other drugs are going to get approved in this space, namely Adstiladrin, which is you know, has about a 25% complete response rate at about a year. So, you know, there's going to be some competition in this space. If you think the patient this is a high risk patient. So I think, you know, having had invasive disease to begin with and having had the recurrence, it may make sense to use more of a systemic therapy than intravesical therapy. But if you have small CIS lesions in the bladder that they're non-invasive, and you know BCG is not working, perhaps those are better suited for continued intravesical treatments.
So Ashish, a couple questions from the audience. What about another round of induction BCG? Somebody else says, what about mitomycin?
So clearly that's the whole reason for this a clarification of this disease state. And in fact, there's data from the 1980s, right, where with increasing rounds of BCG, you're decreasing the response rate, but increasing the death rate of the patient because it becomes an exercise in futility. So if the patient has really met the criteria for BCG unresponsive disease, that is an indication that more BCG is futile. So I wouldn't recommend more BCG in this particular patient. Whether you use another intravesical agent in the absence of an approved drug, which we expect that Stilodrin will be approved, you know, in full disclosure, it was developed at MD Anderson, but it's not approved yet. So non-approved drugs, single agent chemotherapies don't have as robust a response as combination chemotherapies, again, which makes sense. And that's why for these patients, yes, mitomycin has been considered an option in the past, but nowadays we use combination. So some people use mitomycin and docetaxel. Gemcitabine and docetaxel tends to be better tolerated. So that's what a lot of us use.
Another person in the chat room, she says, what about interferon?
So interferon was one of these drugs that got a lot of attention back in the day. Mike O'Donnell did some studies trying to study interferon. And in phase two studies, it did look like interferon would salvage about 35-40% of so-called BCG failure patients. But when it was actually compared head-to-head against BCG, there was no benefit to adding interferon. And when you look at the longer-term data from those studies, the patients that appear to need interferon the most, which is the BCG unresponsive cohort, will not respond to interferon. So the ones that respond are actually the ones that were misclassified earlier. And interferon's really fallen out of favor. It's not even made anymore for this purpose.
So we're going to talk briefly about adjuvant, neoadjuvant therapy. And I really recommend, if you want to see a comprehensive review of this, to check out Sia's lecture that goes through all the data. Really a great presentation. I just want to focus really on a couple of quick issues related to that and really focus on here a little bit about Sia's case. But here's my question to you. And Jonathan, maybe you can comment on this. I'm going to actually refer you back to breast cancer, neoadjuvant therapy of breast cancer. Now, we know that, you know, breast cancer is really at least three diseases, but certainly for ER negative, HER2 negative, triple negative patients, HER2 positive patients, high path CR rates, these people generally get neoadjuvant therapy first. HER2 positive disease, really interesting. Now, if they have residual disease at surgery, they get switched to another agent, TDM1. The other part of breast cancer, not so much neoadjuvant. Right now in breast cancer, Jonathan, you may hear your breast cancer colleagues debating right now about adding an IO to chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. It looks like it increases the past CR rate. Right now, that really has not come into sort of breast cancer management yet. People generally feel there's not enough data. But when I heard Sia presenting the neoadjuvant data, and we're not going to go through all that, Jonathan, I was pretty impressed by the past CR rate, and I kind of wondered why you're not using it right now.
So there's a few reasons I would say. One is that while we think that path CR from neoadjuvant IO therapy as monotherapy probably means the same thing as pathologic response to chemotherapy, we don't know. It's not actually proven to be a surrogate at all in bladder cancer yet, although again, probably is. And you know, the trials that it's based on as neoadjuvant for single agent therapy are small studies. It's not the most robust data sets. In particular, the PURO1 study really was enriched for patients with high levels of PD-L1, probably twice the frequency as you might expect, probably due to patient selection in terms of enrollment. I think the jury is still out in that scenario. And we haven't seen tremendous amount of large trials yet with combination chemoimmunotherapy as a strategy. The phase two studies that have been done have suggested that there might be promise, but the confidence intervals around the CR rates are wide and the downstaging rates are wide. And there are large randomized trials that are either underway or launching to look at deploying immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting in bladder cancer, but we really don't have the data yet. And so I think at this point, you know, there certainly are patients where this would be an ideal therapy. The data suggests that PD-L1 status might be important, at least as monotherapy, and with combination chemotherapy, the jury's out.
So Arjun, again, see, went through all the data that we've seen. There's a meta-analysis on the use of adjuvant chemotherapy that he talks about. But I'm curious about your thoughts about this paper that was just presented at the virtual ASCO meeting, the IMvigor 10-010 trial. Arjun, any comments?
Yeah, I think Jonathan kind of touched on this study. It's the first of several adjuvant immunotherapy trials that admittedly myself and I think many other investigators were very optimistic about. And it basically took patients who had high-risk invasive urothelial cancer with either upper tract tumors or bladder tumors who had undergone cystectomy. Some patients had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, some did not. And those that did not had T3 or higher disease and were not candidates for adjuvant chemotherapy. The majority of these patients were high risk. I think north of 50% of patients had lymph node positive disease at the time of cystectomy. There is an enrichment of PD-L1 positive patients because initially the trial design focused on only PD-L1 positive patients, then it was more broadly and included all patients. But I think the DFS curves that you're looking at right now are, to be honest with you, quite a gut punch in terms of the data we were hoping for versus what we saw. You know, there's a little bit of a separation in the patients who were treated, and it's about a year of therapy. And as you can see, shortly after the year of therapy is done, the curves converge. And that basically tells you that systemic immunotherapy does not lead to cures in the adjuvant setting after surgery. And I think that's really one of the toughest parts. And then it actually raises challenges for the neoadjuvant setting, because then it makes us wonder, are the path CRs that we're seeing to neoadjuvant immunotherapy before cystectomy, are those artifactual, or are they truly prognostic for good outcomes, much like the way we see for neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy? So I think it's kind of forced us to revisit how we think about perioperative immunotherapy in this disease.
So I want to close out this section and just hear about this case. It's so interesting. But first, ask a question to the audience. And Jonathan, I'll let you answer it as well. So we're asking the audience in general, if you have a 77-year-old patient, status post-cystectomy for PT3A N0M0, urothelial bladder cancer, would you recommend adjuvant chemotherapy? We won't even get into what kind, but I just want to know yes or no. Jonathan?
If she's healthy and can take cisplatin, yes.
That's so my answer. It looks like the majority of the audience agrees with you. Let's hear about this case. I think it's a really interesting sort of development. What happened with the 77-year-old lady?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting case. I thought I'd highlight. She actually underwent her TURBT in 2014. This revealed a squamous cell carcinoma that was read out as pure, but it turned out it wasn't, because she underwent cystectomy. We don't recommend for pure squamous cell for patients to undergo neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy. So in October 2014, anterior pelvic exoneration with an extended pelvic lymph node dissection and ileal conduit. And her path showed what we see mostly in this setting, which was this was actually a urothelial carcinoma with squamous differentiation. As you mentioned, PT3A, good nodal count, so we know we have good nodal staging there, so no nodal involvement. As Jonathan pointed out, we did recommend adjuvant chemotherapy. Her kidney function was fine, and she's got four cycles of gemcitabine and cisplatin in March of the following year, several months later. Well, 18 months later, she does fine, and 18 months later, she's got two lung lesions, as you can see there, left upper lobe lung nodules times two, small, completely asymptomatic. It was biopsied and found to be metastatic urothelial carcinoma. And this was not, there was no disease anywhere else. So the question really at this point is, what do you do with that? At that point, we did not have the IOs available, but she did go on a trial. She actually underwent SBRT in two fractions to those lesions after a multidisciplinary discussion, which was interesting. She could have had resection as well, I suppose. Some patients respond to that, but she was treated with atezolizumab in November of that year, develops pneumonitis about 6 months later. As Arjun said, this was in the early days of experience. She was treated with steroids and treatment was discontinued. We fully expected her to progress, and she didn't. I just saw her last week. She's NED, doing extremely well. She's 82, 83 years old. So this really highlights one of two things. One is, does local therapy help when oligometastatic disease and bladder cancer, or really was it the 6 months of immunotherapy? Probably a combination of the two, but we are seeing now these patients who were treated in 2016, 2017, who have long-term durable responses with IO therapy for their metastatic disease.
So Arjun, any comments about oligometastatic disease, what was done in this case? And the other thing I'd like you to comment on is the issue. This patient had pneumonitis, and you know, one of the issues with working up a patient with pneumonitis nowadays is if you got another consideration, which of course in New York is, at least was, even more important, which is COVID. Mm-hmm. So Arjun, any comments on oligomets and the issue of pneumonitis in the era of COVID?
So, you know, the thing in metastatic bladder cancer is that it's rarely ever oligomets. And what you think you're seeing is just the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, over the years, I've had a handful of patients who've had, you know, initially extirpative surgery, and then they have a very long disease-free interval. And then they show up with a lung nodule, and this is an isolated site of recurrence. And those don't happen often, but when they do, you know, you go for it. You either resect or you radiate, and you can observe these patients. And some of them don't recur, and they'll have another long disease-free interval, and then they'll recur again. So this does happen, but it's just not very often. Now, with regard to pneumonitis and just the challenges of treating patients with immunotherapy in the era of COVID, I think this is an issue across all of oncology. And I think it's something that we're kind of grappling with and learning about in real time. I've had a couple of patients where, and one particular patient with metastatic kidney cancer was getting axitinib plus pembrolizumab, developed immune-related hepatitis, but then also at the same time had all of these immune infiltrates in the lungs. I call them immune infiltrates, but was it COVID? Because he turned out to be COVID PCR positive. And it's really a challenge. And we treated this patient with steroids and also at the same time supported him through COVID. So these are going to be challenging issues.
So I'm going to move on now, talk about metastatic disease and, of course, the big plenary presentation. I think it was the first time a bladder trial was presented at a plenary presentation. So just the beginning, I think, in terms of the pace of things that are going on in this field right now. But Jonathan, maybe you could, I really, this is a slide you had in the beginning of your talk that sort of summarizes what's been going on the last couple of years. Can you sort of put everything in perspective, Jonathan?
So for patients who have metastatic disease, you know, we've seen reports of IMvigor 130 and Keynote 361 combination chemo immunotherapy trials versus chemotherapy. And Keynote 361 was reported as negative, and IMvigor 130 has a PFS advantage that's statistically but not totally clearly clinically significant, and is not atezolizumab is not approved in combination with chemotherapy. And so, but we did see the results of the Javelin Bladder 100 study showing that at the end of chemotherapy in responders or people with stable disease, that you have a dramatic improvement in survival with the use of avelumab compared to best supportive care. So for patients with first-line metastatic disease, the standard of care has changed that really for most patients, chemotherapy should be first. Followed by maintenance immunotherapy. There are a subset of patients who are cisplatin ineligible who have high levels of PD-L1 who you might consider upfront checkpoint inhibitor therapy. And so that category of patients clearly still exists. And then there are also patients who are ineligible for chemotherapy who also can get immunotherapy. But I think the paradigm is changing to chemotherapy followed by immunotherapy in many patients with this disease, at least at the moment. And then we have two novel agents that we'll talk about in a little while.
So Arjun, we were doing a program on breast cancer a couple of days ago, and I was telling the breast cancer investigators that bladder cancer is the new breast cancer because you've got all these new agents, all these new strategy. So like there's more going on right now in bladder cancer, I think, than even breast cancer. But maybe you can talk a little bit about this groundbreaking trial that was presented. I guess one other point, too, to keep in mind, I guess it should be emphasized the fact that you can, with cisplatin-based chemotherapy, see some patients who have very good long-term outcomes. So maybe we ought to sort of bracket what we're talking about and keep that in mind, Arjun.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I guess my perspective on the Javelin study is that it's not so much practice changing as it is practice clarifying. And to me, there are several nuances to the maintenance trial. Number one, as you've kind of highlighted, the design of the study is that, now, these are patients where there was an a priori decision to treat these patients with platinum-based chemotherapy, and it's about a 50-50 split of gem-cis and gem-carbo. And then what's required is that after four to six cycles, they have a treatment-free interval of 4 to 10 weeks, and during that time, they're consented and screened. And at that point, they have to actually still be in a stable disease or better, from the start of chemotherapy. And so I think the proportion of patients who are actually in that setting, again, if you have a mixed population of cis and carbo-treated patients, is probably not that high. But if they are, that's great. And then I guess it makes sense to use immunotherapy a bit earlier rather than later, although I wonder how many patients in the best supportive care arm would have gotten immunotherapy at the time of progression if all the enrollment occurred in countries where there's easy access to second-line immunotherapy at the time of progression. But all that being said, this randomized trial showed a benefit in terms of survival. So I think for situations where you're uncomfortable potentially waiting with the next scan, I think it makes a lot of sense to start them on maintenance immunotherapy.
So Ashish, I'm curious about your perspective on this. I highly recommend you all not only to check out Tom Powles' presentation, but Betsy Plimick's discussion of it, about 70% of which I didn't understand, but hopefully you guys can. But really interesting analysis of these data, kind of got to a point where it sort of slipped over my head. But I'm just kind of curious, Ashish, you know, we see almost a 30% relative improvement in survival. Any comments about what kind of advance you see this as?
Yeah, no. So the points that you brought up actually in your comment, where you were, you know, sort of joking in a way, are actually very relevant, because what's happening now is that we have so many different nuances available for us to actually dissect out and figure out what the best treatment for each particular patient is. As Arjun mentioned, and again, you know, Jonathan and Betsy and others have talked about this. This study does have its problems, if you really look at it, but the data is what the data is, and this is what led to the approval, Javelin 100. So we do have an option now. It is something that I would recommend discussing with the patient and starting them on as far as maintenance therapy if they've had a good response. Now, whether this translates into use of this particular IO agent or any other one that a medical oncologist is used to using is anybody's guess, right? Because personally, I don't think there's that much difference between the different agents. And in the US at least, atezo and pembrolizumab have a wider penetrance. So the discussion is, should we use IO as maintenance therapy, whether it's this particular avelumab or something else, depends upon the mix at the particular institution, the payer and other things. But overall, this is a move in the right direction.
So yeah, the question of which one I think is very interesting, Arjun. And although we have approval and, you know, the data here with this 30% reduction, you can see, you know, the chance of being alive or dead at 18 months, 61% versus 44%. But also, and that led to the approval. But Jonathan, also, Arjun brought up in his talk this trial, and also Betsy brought this up in her discussion looking at pembrolizumab. Jonathan, any comments?
Yeah, so this switch maintenance trial is a much smaller trial, a phase two trial with the primary endpoint of progression-free survival with built-in crossover, which really didn't happen in Javelin 100, which is probably one of the flaws that everyone feels is a concern. And so, and there are patients, you know, not all the patients received crossover therapy on Javelin 100, but also, you know, you see in HCRN, the HCRN study, also a relatively similar portion of patients didn't crossover. And so, you know, is pembrolizumab, do we have the data to say that pembrolizumab is the same as avelumab in this context? The answer is no. Do we have supportive data suggesting that it's probably similar? The answer is yes. But, you know, we're stuck with the data we have. And we have, you know, one drug with a robust phase three trial with a very substantial OS advantage. I would argue that, you know, we should follow the data. But there is a problem, particularly age of COVID, that Q2 week therapy, which is what avelumab requires, may not be the best for patients, particularly in areas where COVID is high penetrance, and that perhaps the recent approval of pembrolizumab on Q6 week dosing might be appropriate. You know, I don't think we'd be sacrificing much in terms of efficacy, and we might actually expose fewer people to potential COVID-related illness.
So I'm going to ask Arjun to comment on that, and while he is, I'll ask the audience, how often are you using pembrolizumab? Jonathan brought up the fact that now it's approved every 6 weeks. We have the issue of trying to keep people out of clinic. Obviously, pembrolizumab is used in many different cancers, but I'm just going to say in general, in the urothelial bladder cancer, are you going to use it every 3 weeks or every 6 weeks? And while we see what they're doing, Arjun, any comment on this? You know, of course, oncologists tend to follow the data, but you do have, as Jonathan points out, this compelling practical issue. It looks like a lot of the audience has already flipped over to Q6 weeks. Any comment, Arjun?
Yeah, I mean, I am in favor of Q6 weeks dosing, I think now more than ever because of COVID, and the safety and efficacy profile is identical, if not, you know, similar. And patients prefer it. I mean, I think once the label, you know, kind of change came out. I think I switched over 10 or 15 patients within the first couple of weeks, and each one of them left with a much, much bigger smile on their face that, you know, it was going to be 6 weeks before they had to see me. Maybe it was about me. But so I think it's an advantage. But I think one thing is that when patients first start out, you know, it's good to see them every 3 weeks. And so I think this is really useful in patients who, you know, are kind of cruising, so to speak, on immunotherapy. And it's a good advantage, really.
You know, it's interesting. In people, particularly where there's a lot of COVID, I've heard people say that they'll bring somebody in for an infusion, but yet see them as a telemedicine visit just to minimize the contact there. Let's finish out. I want to give enough time to talk about some of the new agents, but let's just finish out hearing about a case. And Arjun, I thought this patient was really fascinating. Can you comment on what happened there?
Yeah, so the balance of this study is, I mean, this patient is not just about treatment decision making, but also respecting the wishes of the patient and their preferences. So this is a 78-year-old practicing psychologist. He had a history of low-risk prostate cancer on active surveillance. He presented with hematuria in October 2018, and his CAT scan showed a very large bladder mass. He had a cystoscopy and a TUR in November. He had a 6-centimeter posterior wall bladder dome mass. Pathology was consistent with muscle invasive bladder cancer. And when he was referred to me, it was initially for a consultation around neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And then just as he's basically, as I'm stepping out, and he says, you know, by the way, doc, can you take a look? You know, I feel like I've got some mass-like thickening and rigidity of my penis. And so you examine him, and he's basically got malignant priapism. And I think it just had recently developed. So here's some, you know, cross sections of his MRI, and what you see on the sagittal images is infiltration of his penis with several metastases. Now this was not a penis MRI, but you can catch, you know, some portions of it on the scan. I quickly sent him for an FNA. It's metastatic urothelial cancer. His labs are completely normal. His ECOG PS, other than local symptoms related to that, is 0 to 1. And we have a treatment discussion. At this point, I'm counseling him about systemic chemotherapy, and it's really for palliative intent. He's adamant about avoiding immunotherapy. He prefers natural treatments only. I'm able to convince him that immunotherapy is, oddly enough, somewhat natural, even though these are engineered antibodies. But he's willing to accept that. And thankfully, you know, I send his tissue off for tumor for PD-L1 testing. It comes back as CPS 50. So at least I know I'm not making a completely medically negligent decision for this patient. And so he starts single agent pembrolizumab. He gets a total of 3 cycles of treatment. After a second cycle, he tells me the penile mass is less firm. I'm urinating more normally. I feel actually pretty good, a little bit of fatigue. But then I get a scan. It's early March. And at this point, he's got a progression within his penis. He's got new nodules. His bladder mass is bigger. And on diffusion weighted imaging, you can see that he's got new bone metastases involving his pelvic bones. So at this point, we kind of revisit. And at this point, he says he feels completely well. And so no symptoms. And so, of course, you know, we bring up this notion of pseudoprogression. It does happen and happens early. So I've seen it plenty of times. But I'm a little concerned because, you know, what if we guess wrong, right? And at that point, he says, listen, I don't want anything anymore because pembrolizumab made my cancer worse. And I'll be damned if you're going to give me chemotherapy. And so ultimately, we actually monitor this patient and we get another set of scans about a month later. And it shows continued progression. And so at this point, I'm basically holding him hostage in my office room saying, listen, you really got to make a decision about chemotherapy. You know, you're going to progress very quickly, et cetera, et cetera. And then at that point, he more or less disappears. He comes back a couple of months later, and now his disease is shrinking. So his bladder mass is much smaller, his penile masses are smaller, and he's enjoying an excellent quality of life. And at that point, interestingly, the conversation, he's convinced that his natural therapies did, you know, everything that at this point he was taking a variety of supplements and even coffee at high doses. That was another thing that I heard about. But at any rate, so what was very interesting about this patient is that about a year later, he actually progresses clinically. Then at that point, it was true progression. And unfortunately, about just in the early spring of this year, he actually passed away and still did not receive any chemotherapy.
So I want to finish out talking about novel agents, but I do want to ask Sia, I was really interested in the problem, the challenge that was faced with this patient with the malignant priapism. Any comments, Sia?
Penile metastases from urologic cancers, or actually any cancer, is really a bad sign, and patients progress pretty rapidly. I'm surprised actually he had a delayed response of sorts to, I suppose, IO. I don't think high-dose coffee does much. I've tried it myself. But this is somebody who unfortunately sort of refuses first-line treatment, which should have been chemotherapy, as Arjun had recommended to him. I really don't have much. The few patients that we've had with this who progressed on chemo have done really poorly once they have the penile mets.
Jonathan, any comments about sort of what happened here and that the patient seemed like they were progressing and then they had this delayed response? Is this something you see with immunotherapy?
It's rare, but yes, you do see it. And it's in the sort of 5-7% range of patients with single agent checkpoint therapy. As a counterpoint though to this case, I actually have a patient who's now 4 years on nivolumab with response with penile and pelvic bone metastases. When he started treatment. So, it's not a total nihilistic situation necessarily, but certainly with conventional therapy, non-immunotherapy, they really do very poorly, unfortunately. But I've seen it happen. I've seen pseudoprogression occur. Some of it is sort of the stopping the runaway train phenomenon that, the immune system needs some time to mount a response. And so it's not necessarily that it's progressing, but that it's actually just takes time for the tumors to respond. But I usually if I see some progression and the patient feels well, at the first scan, I continue, do a scan another 6 to 9 weeks later and see what the trajectory is. And often it stabilizes or starts to shrink somewhat, and then you kind of stay on therapy. And so it's, there's the delayed response versus the, true pseudoprogression, worse than better. And I think the jury is still out on exactly how frequent that is.
I guess the thing we've been hearing from the melanoma people for a long time is if the patient's doing well, they're clinically stable, keep going, if the imaging. So let's finish out talking about these two novel agents that have come into practice. And again, Jonathan did a great comprehensive review of both of these. Arjun, of course, we're talking about, first of all, erdafitinib, the EGFR TKI. And rather than go through all the data, and again, you can check out Jonathan's talk. Maybe you could just focus a little bit, Arjun, on sort of your impression, both in terms of the efficacy, pretty good looking spider plot, but also tolerability, Arjun.
Yeah. So, the history of targeting VEGFR inhibitors in bladder cancer is a pretty long story, but I think we're much better at identifying what the activating alterations are. We have NGS platforms that can do it reliably, and we have drugs that I think are good targets for it. And the 40% response rate, I think, is reflective of a good development strategy and a good drug. The tolerability is unique. Their ocular toxicities, patients have fatigue, they'll have, skin and nail changes, they have hyperphosphatemia. And for, for this class of drugs, which are very unique, sending a patient to an ophthalmologist for a pre-treatment evaluation is not something that most oncologists are used to doing. So I think it's something that we've had to evolve and include. And then there's this dose titration based on phosphate levels. So when we treat our patients, we counsel them about these unique toxicities, but also tell, listen, you're going to meet more physicians in the course of your care because we need to monitor you closely.
So if you check out our GYN program next Tuesday, you'll hear about tisotumab vedotin as an antibody-drug conjugate that's being used there in cervical cancer. And Jonathan, one of the things about antibody-drug conjugates is sometimes they have kind of weird tolerability issues. A number of them have ophthalmic issues, as Arjun was just talking about. Can you talk about what's been seen here with erdafitinib? Because it seems pretty unusual. Central serous retinopathy.
Right. Well, this is a TKI. This is a MAP kinase pathway toxicity. It's seen with several other TKIs targeting these pathways. It's generally reversible when you stop the drug. On the bottom there, you see what are called AMSLR grids that you can give a patient. You can have a patient print out, and they can look and see if there's any change in their vision. If they start seeing wiggly lines, they need to hold the drug and see the ophthalmologist. But over time, it can go away. But there are patients who do progress to more serious retinal issues. But it's a relatively small number of patients, and you can see here only 3% of patients had real problems. But with antibody drug conjugates, they'd get often, which is a different class of drugs, get some keratitis and some other issues more with the cornea rather than as much with the retina.
So speaking of antibody drug conjugates, that's the other novel agent we want to talk about, enfortumab vedotin. Arjun, can you kind of review sort of the basis of kind of what how antibody drug conjugates work? Yeah. We have brentuximab vedotin in lymphomas, T-DM1 in breast cancer, sacituzumab is another one in breast cancer, trastuzumab deratoxan. How do these agents work, Arjun?
Yeah, in general, basically, it involves a antigen-specific antibody that is conjugated or linked to a very potent cytotoxic payload. You know, the advances recently in the terms of technology are mostly around the linker, which means that it stays very stable systemically. It's only only becomes really active when it gets to a cell surface protein that actually matches the antibody that you're targeting. And then in this case, in the case of enfortumab vedotin, it's a hydrolyzable linker that is endocytosed and really just has its intracellular effects. And it allows us to more safely deliver a highly toxic compound that otherwise would not have a therapeutic index if given alone, you know, systemically. And it also narrows the safety profile a bit. And so, for instance, with enfortumab and MMAE, which is the payload here, you know, the safety profile is, you know, skin toxicity, neuropathy, hair loss, and there's some hyperglycemia metabolic events. But we don't see much in the way of marrow toxicity, which is really good, especially with many of these patients who have had extensive prior therapies.
And Jonathan, maybe you can comment a little bit about the activity of this agent. It seems pretty substantial, and I hear stories from people telling me about cases of people have, you know, symptom improvement and, you know, good responses. Can you talk about the data, but also your clinical experience, Jonathan?
Yeah, so the data from the phase one and the phase two study are remarkably similar. In patients who've had prior immunotherapy and prior chemotherapy, the response rate is around 44%. We see the waterfall plot on this slide. We're showing the vast majority of patients have tumor reduction and that the many patients are ongoing close to a year or more. I've had a few patients who've had, you know, really almost Lazarus-like responses on the phase one study and continue on therapy for quite a long time. My own experience with toxicity is the three that are listed here, fatigue, rash, and neuropathy. Most of the time, patients, if they make it through the first few months, the fatigue is manageable. But the rash can be difficult, and the neuropathy can be progressive as time goes on and can require dose reduction and holding doses for neuropathy. I generally connect patients with the dermatologist early on in their treatment for enfortumab if they have toxicities. From the skin toxicity, which can be very variable from just itching to macular rashes to papular rashes to bullous diseases even. And so it can be a handful occasionally to manage the skin toxicity. But, you know, in a patient where the drug is working, you really want to try to maximize use of the agent if you're able to.
So Arjun, it just seems like there's so many trials out there where they're trying combinations with novel agents plus mm-hmm. checkpoint inhibitors, chemo, et cetera. It's so hard to evaluate. Sometimes you only have one, you know, arm to look at. But, you know, this concept of enfortumab plus checkpoint inhibitor sounds pretty interesting, specifically enfortumab plus pembro, Arjun. Mm-hmm. Any comments on that and where you see that heading?
Yeah, so I think this is probably one of the more exciting trials or the development strategies that we're kind of anticipating over the coming years. A little bit of context, I think myself and other investigators had noticed that patients who had had prior immunotherapy and then got enfortumab had what appeared to be immune-like responses, where even what looked like pseudoprogression. And then, you know, I had a couple of patients that I rechallenged with immunotherapy after enfortumab that actually subsequently responded. And so there was some at least clinical indication that there may be some evidence of immune synergy or immune potentiation with enfortumab. And so these two were combined as part of a single arm phase one trial within the EV-103 program, looking at enfortumab plus pembrolizumab in cisplatin ineligible patients. And what it showed and what, you know, Jonathan, you know, updated at ASCO shows that about 73% of patients achieved an objective response, 93-94% at least had some degree of tumor shrinkage. And the median duration of response has not yet been reached with over about 2 years of follow-up. So I think that's pretty incredible. We don't really see data like that. I mean, it's a 47-patient trial, and so we need to expand it and study it more. But I think these data suggest that this is something that could completely change how we treat this disease.
So we're going to finish out with a case from Jonathan. But first, I'm going to ask the audience another question, which is if you have a patient who has an FGFR genetic alteration, which of course you need in order to get erdafitinib. So in a patient who's eligible to get erdafitinib and enfortumab in general, what would your sequence be? Would you go with erdafitinib first, or would you go with and Fortinav vedotin. And while we're kind of seeing how people respond, I guess, Jonathan, it kind of seems indirectly that maybe enfortumab is maybe better tolerated and more effective. How do you generally sequence these two, Jonathan, and patients are eligible for both?
Yeah, so I had been sequencing the FGFR inhibitor first, but for the toxicity and tolerability reasons, I've started to switch to use enfortumab first. I think, you know, there is something to target the tumor driver, and FGFR3 is a tumor driver. I've had some patients who've had a tough time on erdafitinib. And while I do think enfortumab has toxicity, it's often better tolerated in my experience.
Quick question from the audience, Jonathan. Somebody mentions that they saw neutropenia and a patient who got enfortumab. You mentioned that's not too common. Have you seen that, Jonathan?
I've seen it. It's pretty rare. I've seen more anemia and more thrombocytopenia over time, but the rates are relatively low. The thrombocytopenia tends to be mild to moderate. You know, if it happens, it's in the 50 to 100 range, and patients can get anemic. But I have not personally had much neutropenia, and have had very few patients who've had to hold doses. But it does occur, and you know, everyone's bone marrow is different and depends on some of the prior therapies, I imagine.
So again, Arjun, what tends to be your first of these two sequentially in a patient who's eligible for both? Yeah. How do you usually approach that?
I mean, I think some of this could be just my experience with the drug. I have more experience with enfortumab. I tend to use that in third line. I've had similar experiences as Jonathan, which is that it tends to rescue patients from their disease. And even in patients who don't achieve a response, it has a significant palliative effect, in particular with bone pain, where other interventions such as radiation and others, you really can't even match it. So, and for the most part, because prior therapies can sometimes preclude, you know, because of myelotoxicity, I don't see much of it. I had one patient with very severe neutropenia, but that's about it. So I've generally used enfortumab.
So let's finish out just briefly hearing about your 74-year-old man, Jonathan. Also, there's a question in the chat room. Would you ever consider using either one of these agents before an IO, Jonathan?
So there's a tiny, tiny bit of data for erdafitinib. 12 patients in the BLC 2001 study were treatment naive and received erdafitinib and had a 40%+ response rate. But it's 12 patients, so... So I don't. If there's a specific contraindication for someone to receive immunotherapy, they've got bad lupus, they've got some other autoimmune disease, of course, you know, you have to treat the patient that's in front of you and not the guideline. But in general, I'm at the moment treating them post-immunotherapy, unless they're on
a trial. I guess as a measure of, you know, where we are today, you can comment on this 74-year-old man who I think maybe a year or two ago would have been heading for hospice.
Right,
at the point that he had severe pain because of pelvic involvement, high dose opiates. What happened when you gave him enfortumab?
Yeah, so essentially the third visit of treatment, cycle 1, day 15, he had been coming in a wheelchair previously. He walked into the office. He was using a walker, but his pain had improved dramatically. He was ambulatory from there on out. He eventually did unfortunately progress in the sacrum, different area in the pelvis with severe pain. And we tried, you know, it was this oligo progression. We tried to do radiation to that spot and then resume EV, but the disease progressed elsewhere, unfortunately.
So thanks so much to our faculty. Thank you all for attending.